Thank you. May be seated. Thank you so much. Let me ask you to open your Bible to Ruth chapter 1. Thank you. All right. Open your Bibles, please, to Ruth chapter 1. All right. Ruth chapter 1, if you'd open there. Ruth chapter 1, if you'd open there right quick. Ruth chapter 1. My wife and I had the privilege to rear three, I always say, beautiful daughters. And all three of our daughters are married to preachers. All three of our daughters are in full-time Christian ministry with their husbands. While we were rearing our daughters, one of the things that we tried to do on a regular basis, and we're like any other family, we did not score 100, but we made an effort to spend some time in the Bible together on a daily basis in our home. I did not want God and the Bible to only be at church. I did not want God and the Bible to only be at the Christian school. I wanted it to be common in our home. So every day we would read, basically every day we would read the Bible together. So I tried to find portions of the Bible that I thought would be interesting to my daughters. If I had had sons, of course, I would have altered it a little bit. But I tried to find portions of the Bible that I thought would be interesting to them, that would keep their attention, that would apply to them. So we read the book of Ruth many, many times. You know, it's the love story in the Bible, so I knew that would interest them. And believe it or not, we read it so many times that the book of Ruth became one of my favorite books in the Bible. Now, you would think, you know, a fellow like me growing up in Louisiana, out in the country, on a dead-end dirt road, spending much of my life on the bayous and in the swamps, you wouldn't think Ruth would be one of my, you know, you'd think maybe 1st or 2nd Samuel, where they're all killing each other and so forth. But Ruth became one of my favorite books in the Bible. I've probably read the book of Ruth as just about as many times as I've read any book of the Bible, except maybe the book of Proverbs. And not long ago, I was reading the book of Ruth again for I don't know how many times. And I noticed one little phrase that I'd never noticed before. We're going to start this morning in Ruth chapter 1 in verse 1. Let me ask you to give me your undivided attention, if you would, please. Ruth chapter 1 verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled, that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah," that'd be like Chicago, Illinois, Crown Point, Indiana, Bethlehem, Judah, the same city where Jesus would be born later. "There was a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi, and the name of his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites," that means that's the tribe they were from, "of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. And they," the two sons, "took them wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelled there about 10 years. And Mahlon and Chilion died also, both of them. And the woman, Naomi," the mother, the wife of the family, "was left of her two sons and her husband." And I know that all of you are familiar with the rest of the story. But instead of taking time to read the whole book this morning, I'll briefly remind you that sometime after this, Naomi apparently heard that things were going a little better back in Bethlehem, and so she decided to go back home and live with her family. She said to her two daughters-in-law, "I'm going to go home and live with my family. Why don't you stay here and live with your family?" Orpah said, "Sounds like a good idea. I think I will." Ruth said, No, Mom, I think I'll go with you. And so she did. And when they got back to Bethlehem, sure enough, things were going better. Maybe it started raining or something, I don't know, but somehow things were going better. People were doing better than they had before. But Naomi and Ruth still had a problem. Neither one of them were married. And so they were very, very poor. It was not as common back then for a lady to work outside the home as it is today. But they had a system in their culture and their land in that day, similar to a system that we have here in America. The two systems are not similar, but it's similar that we have a system and they had one. Our system today that we have, that we help people who are in poverty, we call it sometimes the welfare system. In their day, they had a system. It kind of went like this. If I own some land and I raise a crop to provide for my family, and I hire some men to come into my field and harvest my crop, when those hired reapers go through the field the first time, if they accidentally miss a stalk or two here and there of wheat or barley or rye or corn or whatever, or maybe they accidentally leave a little in the corner, or maybe they drop some as they're reaping, they're not allowed to go back through the field the second time. Even though it's my field, even though I hired them to work for me, law was I couldn't let my reapers go through a second time because what accidentally got left behind was for the poor people. So Naomi says to Ruth, "You know, Mom, you're a little older than me. I hate to word it that way, Mom, but, you know, I'm a little younger than you, and maybe I have a little more strength left than you do, and so it's very hot out there in those fields, and especially in that part of the world, it always was." And so she said, "Mom, I know working here at the house is hard work, but being out in the sunshine adds a little to it, and so, Mom, why don't you stay here and do the housework, and I'll go out in the field, and I'll try to get us something to eat." And so Ruth did. She went out in the field, and she's going from field to field, and she's picking up grain. One day, she winds up in the field that's owned by a man by the name of Boaz. Boaz apparently was a quite wealthy man. He owned several different fields. The Bible even specifically mentions how wealthy he is. And one day, he winds up at the field where Ruth happens to be picking up grain. And when he gets there, he notices her. You know, the Bible talks about being fair to look upon. And so he noticed her. Boaz asked one of the men that's working for him. He said, "Hey, who's that good looking chick? I mean, who's that? Who's that young lady?" And the reaper says, "Oh, she's the young new widow in town." He says, "Oh, she is, huh?" So Boaz says to the reaper, "Look, don't let her leave. I got to go home and comb my hair and shave and take a shower and change clothes, and I'll be right back. Don't you let her leave while I'm gone." He said, "Don't accidentally drop a little grain while you're harvesting." He said, "Take out some handfuls on purpose and put them on the ground right in front of her and keep her here until I get back." And they did, and he did, and he came back. And Boaz and Ruth met each other. They fell in love. You know the story. It's a great love story. If you haven't read it recently, I'd recommend you do so again. And they got to the point where they wanted to be engaged. Now, in their land, their custom was a little different than ours. In our land, if you're going to get engaged, that's usually somewhat kind of private. When my first daughter was going to get engaged to a young man she met here at the college, his family came down from Michigan and picked up the two of them and took them back up to Michigan to a pier that goes out into Lake Michigan at St. Joe. There's a lighthouse out on the end of it. And his parents were there to chaperone them, but they let him have a little privacy, let him walk out on the pier by themselves. And he got down on his knee and he proposed to her. When my second daughter was going to get engaged, his family came up from Texas and picked up my daughter and her husband-to-be and took them up to Chicago. And they were in Grant Park there by the lake shore. And they gave the couple a little bit of privacy and let them walk off to the other side of the park. And there under a tree, he got down on his knee and proposed to her. When my third daughter was going to get engaged to a young man that she, like the other two, met here at the college, they were going to get engaged, but she didn't know it. He invited her to his home in Ohio to supposedly meet his family, but my wife and I knew the plan, so we took her over there to meet his family, and that we were going to meet on Saturday morning at his church. And when we got there, there was some children's classes going on, so he took my daughter for a tour of his home church and showed her where he went to, you know, junior class and primary class and junior high and high, you know, all that. And they wound up back in the auditorium, and she thought the two of them were in the auditorium by themselves, but she didn't know that my wife and I and his parents and the pastor and his wife, we were all hiding in the corner in the back under the balcony in the dark. That part of the auditorium was dark. And he brought her down to the altar here, and he got down on his knees, and he said, "I've made all the important decisions of my life right here in this very spot." And she's still thinking tour of the church, the way God's, you know, used the church to help him. And then he reaches in his pocket and pulls out the ring and says, "And now this decision I want to..." And of course she squeals and her mother cries and, you know, all that stuff. In our culture today, the engagement's simple, kind of private. The wedding's the big ceremony. You invite the public. You have legal documents. You have to sign the marriage license and so forth and so on. Their custom was exactly the opposite. They had weddings and they invited friends, but the big legal ceremony was the engagement. In fact, in order to get engaged, just like in our culture, to get married, you have to have a justice of the peace or a judge or a minister, ordained minister, or it varies from state to state. In their day, if you wanted to get engaged, you had to go to court. You had to appear before a judge. He convened a court case, a court session, and he heard testimony. Now, some of you that grew up in the South, I don't think this is very common anymore, but when I grew up in the South, it was still a very common thing that at all the weddings, they would always ask, "Is there anybody here today who knows why there's any reason why this couple should not be able to get married?" And I don't know why they asked that question. I never one time in my whole life heard anybody say, "Yeah, I'll tell you why," you know. But they always used to ask that question. Well, that came from this custom in the Bible that at the engagement, the judge actually had to hear testimony. He had to listen to people testify about whether they should or should not get married, and then he had to make a judgment based on their laws and rules and customs of their day. So Boaz and Ruth has their engagement ceremony in front of the judge. The judge hears the testimony, and then the judge makes a decision that, yes, this couple, Boaz and Ruth, they do have legal right to become engaged. And at the end of that ceremony, some of their loved ones and friends that were there to wish God's blessing upon their marriage made this statement. And this is the little phrase I had never noticed before. They said, "Let thy house be like the house of Pharaoh." And I'll be honest with you, when I noticed that phrase for the first time after reading the book many times, my first thought was, whoever Pharaoh was must have had a good house. If they're saying to their loved ones that they love and they're wishing God's blessing upon them, "Let thy house be like the house of Pharaoh," then apparently Ferris must have had a good house. And then my second thought was, who was Ferris? Honestly, I couldn't remember at the time. So I made a note in my little notebook that I keep where I study my Bible every morning, study the house of Ferris. Now, let me quickly tell you another story. This other story took place about 400 years before the story of Boaz and Ruth. In this story, there is a family that has four mothers. And when I say four mothers, I don't mean a man got married and his wife died and he got married again and his wife died. And no, and I'm not even talking about a case where a man got married and got a divorce, got married again, got a divorce. No, I'm talking about there was a family that had four mothers, and all four mothers, listen to me carefully, were all married to the same man at the same time. Listen carefully. And not only were they married to the same man at the same time, worse than that, they all four lived in the same house with the same man at the same time. And listen carefully. In addition to that, two of the four women were sisters that already hated each other before they ever married the same man. Listen carefully. Can you even imagine how much chaos, how much confusion, strife, bickering, just plain hatred there was in that family in that kind of a situation? In fact, there was so much hatred. One day, 11 of the 12 sons were out in the field taking care of the sheep, and the 12th one, not 12th in birth order, but the 12th one, is approaching, and one of the 11 says, "Here he comes, that little punk that we all hate. Why don't we kill him?" And he didn't mean killing, bang, bang, video game, you're dead. He meant blood, you're killing. And the other 10 agreed to it. Listen carefully. But one of them said, "Hey, I hate the punk as much as the rest of you do, but I don't want his nasty old blood on my hands. Let's throw him in a pit and let him starve to death," as if that might be a better way to die. And so they did. They threw him in a pit to let him starve to death. And there was so much hatred in that family that while he's in the pit, a caravan comes by. One of the 11's missing, so the other 10 are there. And one of the 10 says, "Hey, I want to get rid of the punk as much as the rest of you do, but why don't we make a little off of it? Instead of just letting him starve to death, let's take him up out of the pit and sell him to these people. They'll take him down to Egypt. That'll get rid of him just as well as anything else will, and at least we can make a few bucks off of it." And the Bible says that when they put the shekels on his feet that caused wounds, and they drug him off across the desert, maybe tethered to the back of a camel or something, that with anguish of soul, this young man begged his brothers not to do this. But I can see those 10 brothers just standing there, so much hatred, that they just stood there jingling the coins in their pocket that they had received for selling their own brother into slavery. So much hatred in this family that those 10, when the other 11 got back, told him what they had done, and the 11 all agreed, we'll go home and make Dad think that a wild beast ate him. Now, I've never experienced this, but I've been around some families that have, and I can't think of any grieving process that would be any worse than a family losing a child at what we call an untimely death. It's bad enough just to lose a child. But on top of that, to honestly think that he was eaten alive by a wild beast, can you imagine the grieving that father went through? And can you see the 11 brothers standing there nonchalantly jingling the coins in their pocket that they got for selling their brother into slavery? The one who came up with the idea, "Hey, let's sell him as a slave," his name was Judah. Judah was so hard to get along with that he couldn't live with the rest of the family, so he had to move away. When he moved away, he married a girl outside their race, outside their religion, which was against their religion back in that day. just to spite the rest of the family. And when he did, everyone listening carefully now, when he did, Judah and his wife had a son by the name of Ur. Ur grew up, married a girl named Tamar. But Ur was so wicked, God killed him. When I say so wicked, God killed him, I don't mean he got sick and died. I mean the Bible specifically says, so wicked, the Lord slew him. They had a custom in their day that if you died without children, your brother would marry your wife and rear up children in your name. And so Judah allowed his second son, Onan, to marry Tamar, and he was so wicked, God killed him too. Judah had a third son by the name of Shelah, and he was a bit younger because Judah said to Tamar, if you'll be a widow on purpose, that means they dress in a certain attire that says to everybody, I'm a widow, but I'm not available for dating or anything like that. If you'll be a widow on purpose long enough, when Shelah gets old enough, I'll let him marry you. When Shelah became old enough, Judah finally admitted that he had been lying to her all that time, and he told her, I'm not going to let you marry Shelah after all. About that time, Judah's wife died. Judah decides to go on a trip. He's grieving over the death of his wife, so he's going to get away for a while. He's going to go out where some men are shearing his sheep, and his best friend goes with him. Somebody comes to Tamar and says to Tamar, I know where your father-in-law went. She quickly takes off the attire of a widow and puts on what the Bible calls the attire of a harlot. And I know we're in a mixed crowd. I'll be very careful about the way I tell this real story that actually happened. She puts on the attire of a harlot, which includes a veil over her face so nobody can know who she is. She makes an end-around move. She gets in front of her father-in-law. She sets up a tent on the side of the road. When he comes by, she entices her father-in-law on purpose. Not a desperate woman who's trying to feed some kids or something like that. And I'm not condoning anything whatsoever, but I'm saying it's not even that. She does it just to spite her father-in-law. And she says, what are you going to pay me? And he says, well, I'm going to get my sheep, check on my sheep. I'll send one back tomorrow. She says, how do I know for sure you'll do that? He said, well, I'll leave my staff. It was a rod that they carried for protection and so forth. And he said, I'll leave my bracelet. And he said, I'll leave my signet. It was sort of like our ID or our passport or our driver's license or something of that nature. It was very personalized. Everybody knew which one was yours. The next day, the friend comes back with the sheep, and he looks around. He can't find the harlot. The tent's gone. He asks the people in the village, where's that harlot that was here yesterday? And they said, harlot? We've never had a harlot in our town before. And he said, well, there was one here yesterday. And they said, you're mistaken. We've never had one here. So he takes the sheep back to Judah. Judah says, oh, well. He goes back home. 3 months later, Tamar comes in, and she says to her father-in-law, I'm expecting. I mean, have you ever heard of a more distorted story? I mean, Hollywood couldn't make up something this distorted. He is angry, furious. He says, I demand to know who the father is. And she says, well, it's the man who owns this. And maybe she reaches over behind the curtain and pulls out this staff that looks kind of familiar. And the man who owns this bracelet looks a little more familiar. And the man who owns this signet, and now he can't deny. She was expecting twins. And when those twins were born, one of them was named Pharis. And 400 years later, in the nation of Israel, if you wanted to wish God's blessing upon someone's home, the common way to do it was to say, let thy house be like the house of Pharis. Pharis must have had a good house. Not just a good house, he must have had the best house. And not just the best house in his generation. For 400 years later, they were still saying, let thy house be like the house of Pharis. I never heard anybody say, let thy house be like the house of Abraham. I never heard anybody say, let thy house be like the house of Joseph. I never heard anybody say, let thy house be like the house of David. I never heard anybody say, let thy house be like the house of Daniel. He must have had for 400 years, it just got passed down. Let your house be like Pharisee's house. Let your house be like Pharisee's house. You know, like we say, happy birthday, Merry Christmas, God bless you, have a good day, Happy New Year. Nobody set you down in a classroom and taught you that. It just gets passed down from generation to generation. It's just a common part of our culture. It was so common that everybody knew that Pharisee had a great house. And my point is this. If Pharisee can have a good house, you can have a good house. And I know somebody's sitting here today. I get it. And you're thinking, hey, yeah, Brother Young, you have no idea where I came from. Oh, was your situation worse than Pharisee's? I mean, Pharisee's grandfather had four wives. Pharisee's grandmothers that were married to the same man got down on the floor and wrestled with each other. The Bible said there was a great wrestling between them. Now, you can interpret that any way you want to, but I see them down on the floor pulling hair and biting and scratching. And he said there was a great wrestling between them. Oh, Pharisee. His father was a whoremonger. His mother was a harlot on purpose with her own father-in-law. His uncles, they hated each other so much they tried to kill each other. They hated each other so much they sold each other into slavery. And by the way, Pharisee, he didn't even have this book right here to help him rear his family. I mean, I made this a central part of my home when I was rearing my daughters, but Pharisee didn't have it. It hadn't been recorded here on the earth yet. Pharisee didn't have a pastor to help him rear his family. Oh, I can't even begin to remember how many times I went to Brother Howells and said, Brother Howells, what should I do about this? And Brother Howells, what should I do about this? And Brother Howells, you didn't tell me about this. Now what do I do? And he didn't have a pastor to help him. He didn't have a Sunday school. I wonder which Sunday school class his mother took him to. The harlot Tamar. I wonder which vacation Bible school his father Judah took him to. I don't care what your situation. Okay. I care that your situation is difficult. But I'm here to say, difficult or not, God is able to help you have a good home. If Pharisee can have a good home in the mess he came from, with all the advantages you've had, now I understand some of you have had great disadvantages, but add to that some great advantages, this book, a good church, a good pastor, good Sunday school teachers, the privilege to attend a college like this, and then books written about marriage and marriage seminars and so forth. Look, don't let the world tell you that your marriage has to be like everybody else's out there that's a big mess and a wreck. It does not have to be that way. My whole sermon is this, and I know it took me a long time to get to my, that was my introduction. Here's my sermon, and I got ahead of myself and preached it ahead of time. My sermon is, if Pharisee can have a good house, you can have a good house. Thank you.